Darcy Weir is an investigative filmmaker who's been making a series of documentaries on UFOs, secret space programs, underground bases, Area 51, Phil Schneider, the Dulce in New Mexico base, and Sasquatch. And he's also interested in the connections between UFO sightings in China, Russia, and the United States. And today he's here to talk about his documentaries and upcoming film projects.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Welcome, Darcy, to Exopolitics Today.
Hey, Michael, thank you for having me.
Great to have you on the show. I mean, you've been quite prolific in terms of your output, the documentaries you've been putting out. So why don't you just, for my audience that maybe know very little about you, why don't you tell us from the beginning your film making background, your education, and then what got you interested in the whole UFO scene?
Okay, yeah, sure. I started off as a young filmmaker interested in the UFO phenomenon. And back in 2012, I released my first attempt at a feature length documentary straight to YouTube. That documentary was about Phil Schneider, who's, you know, quite an interesting character in the phenomenon, the ufology community. And he talked about underground bases and extraterrestrials and his experience working on building an underground base and getting into a fight with one of these alien races or something. And I don't think all of what he said was true, but I think he touched on a lot of ideas that exist in ufology that still resonate today, that still are prevalent in the discussion in the community. And so I realized that I liked making documentaries, you know, over a decade ago. And I just have been working on many other documentaries within ufology. I did two on Sasquatch, the cryptid phenomenon. And I have done one on Bitcoin or cryptocurrency called the Bitcoin Field Guide. So I'm just interested in really fringe thoughts, I guess, stuff that's not very widely accepted by the mainstream.
Yeah, well, that Phil Schneider, that case has always fascinated me. I think that was one of the ones very early on that I kind of looked at closely, and you know, there were other people talking about this Dulce firefight. So this Dulce base, there, you want to kind of like maybe talk a little bit about what you found out from your kind of research into Phil Schneider about this multi-level underground base there in somewhere in the Archuleta Mesa near the town of Dulce, New Mexico.
Well, he made claims that he was partly responsible for building it. I think the allure of something being, you know, like a underground base existing under the Archuleta Mesa has been around for a while, because the Navajo, the indigenous people of that area of New Mexico, they've spoken of things like the ant people and these non-human intelligence that supposedly have been there in the desert for a long time, probably before we've even been there. And then, you know, you have myths and reports of UFOs coming out of the Mesa or coming over top of the Mesa for a long, long time, decades now. Being seen by the locals who live in the city of Dulce. And look, you've got Los Alamos, which is the old Manhattan Project city that was set up in the 1940s and still exists today. And it's very possible that all that combined kind of gives confirmation to people to believe that there's an underground base. Whether there is or not, I don't know. My story just touched on all of that stuff I just mentioned to you, and it allows people to have an idea of what is believed regarding that conspiracy theory.
Kind of middle of 1995, he started talking about his experiences, showed a lot of documentation, and these documents were always shown in these videos that are kind of like, you know, they're quite dated and pretty grainy, so you don't really get to appreciate the quality of the documentation. But I know your documentary on Phil Schneider, you actually got your hands on some of these documents. So how persuasive were these documents in convincing you that there was something to his case?
Yeah, I think the thing that really persuaded me that something he was saying was true were the pictures of his father working on the USS Nautilus, which is the very first nuclear-powered submarine within the Navy. His father supposedly was brought over under Project Paperclip and worked for NATO on Navy missions. And his name was Otto Schneider. So it is a German surname for sure. Philip was a married man. He had a child with Cynthia Dreyer, and she shared a lot of this documentation, photos and stuff that Phil was taking on lecture tour while he was alive, doing his thing. And, you know, he had a untimely death in 1996. And we kind of cover that in the documentary, but, it's hard to tell, you know, what is the total truth there. I think people want to believe everything he said is true, but I don't know if there was like an alien battle, you know. Something rings fictional to me about that. But I think he layered on some of that fictional stuff, possibly with realities, you know, stuff that possibly are very true, like deep underground military bases being constructed by the militaries of the world. These are strategic assets. They can keep technology and testing of that technology out of sight and out of sound from the public. Then you also have the idea that maybe there's these cooperations or these programs that are jointly being conducted between a non-human intelligence and humans on Earth, you know, another good place to facilitate that stuff out of sight and out of sound might be underground, right? So that is the idea. Whether we can prove that or not is really hard unless we get more and more documentation and testimony from people. It's just that sort of interesting, I guess, like fable being put on top of possible truth. And it's kind of obfuscated whether what is true and what is not. You know, even things like the secret space program, I think you've spoke about before, there's probably a lot of truth to that. But then there's like this fabled, sort of science fictionized characters and stories that have come out of ufology that have kind of glommed onto that subject, and it ends up obfuscating the truth from reality.
Yeah, separating the signal from the noise is really the job of the investigator, the researcher, and you know, and that's not easy because you get really good operatives who actually infiltrate the community, and they can insert this information. You get people that say MK Ultra, and they might truly believe that they went through things and they reveal it. So, you know, my approach to the whole thing has always been to say, well, if someone comes forward and talks about something, do they have something to lose? That person is more likely to be credible as opposed to someone who's just like doesn't have any kind of career and they just kind of come out of left field and they start saying that, oh, they were on this secret space program or that secret space program. That, people who have been in things, they actually have careers, they have reputations, and they don't want to risk that.
Do you, just to segue a bit, do you think there's a lot of noise or signal when you hear from testimony like Corey Good?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I think there was a lot of signal there. I mean, I actually did work with him and I got to speak with some of the insiders that he works with. And one is like a general within NATO. And I got to meet the guy and spend a little bit of time with him, and absolutely real, a NATO general.
Was that Bob Wood?
No. He's aerospace corporation. I think he just decided at some point that he was going to become a gatekeeper, and that at a certain point he also decided that he was going to assert his intellectual property right over all of his testimony, and that's where things started to go a little bit south, because there were court cases, and I think the big problem is that he then said in his trial, in the deposition, that he said that some of his stuff that he didn't physically leave Earth, which is contrary to what he had told us prior, that his kind of off-world experiences were like astral traveling, out-of-body experiences, his creative imagination. So, I think this was all tied into the court case. And but what he did was he just kind of like made it very difficult to sort out the noise from the signal. And he did it himself.
Right, that's too bad. And I think that's the problem. You get a lot of, in ufology, you get a ton of egos, right? And sometimes those egos get in the way of the truth as well. It prevents, people end up thinking that there's so much money to be made by telling these stories that they want to kind of control it. They want to control the story and the narrative, whereas, truth is like a lion, right, Michael?
That's right.
And, when truth gets out there like a lion does, it's going to probably dominate and finally rise to the top. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, that this field is one where, when I began, and certainly during the days of Phil Schneider, there wasn't a lot of money to be made. It was actually the opposite, that you would risk your livelihood, your financial livelihood, if you came out in support of this. But now, over the last 10 years, 5 years or so, there is money around, and people can, want to become gatekeepers and want to assert intellectual property, and that's a problem, unfortunately. And it kind of lends itself into the whole psychological operation to create a lot of smoke and mirrors around this. I mean, Edward Snowden, one of the NSA documents he released actually showed that the Five Eyes countries had online deception programs, and they involved, and the UFO area was part of that. So, right there you have like this GCHQ document that Snowden released from the NSA archives, showing that Five Eyes countries, the intelligence community, were conducting online deception programs dealing with UFOs and other topics.
Do you think media agencies, let's say UFO-related entertainment companies like Gaia might be slightly infiltrated by an intelligence operation?
I think Gaia kind of is a good example of a company that mixes a lot of noise and signal. You get some, like some of their guests, there's a lot of signal. They're really on the money in terms of like what's going on. And then there's a lot of noise. I think there is a few that just like, have incredible stories, but there's no real effort to document or to prove them to be real. And it's just an entertaining story.
It's kind of like truth by proclamation. I say, therefore it is.
Yeah. And ancient aliens, where they come up with something similar. It's like, according to ancient alien theorists,
same. I like thing. That line. Yeah. I've heard it before. I've heard it a couple times before.
Yeah, whenever they don't know anything for sure, they just say, "Well, according to ancient alien theorists or researchers,
therefore it's true."
Therefore it's true. Okay, so you talked about. The Phil Schneider's father serving on the USS Nautilus. So that brings up something that William Tompkins told me. And William Tompkins, he's one of the more credible people in terms of the secret space programs, what really happened, because he did work at Douglas Aircraft Company in the 1950s and 60s, and a bunch of other aerospace companies, and he had a lot of documents showing that he worked there, that he was part of a Navy espionage program. He has documentation proving that. But in his book, he talks about one of the projects that he was involved with or knew about was that when the Navy was developing, I mean, they asked this organization or this think tank within Douglas Aircraft Company that William Tompkins called Advanced Design, they asked for a design of a space carrier. They asked the Douglas engineers to develop a space carrier. And the thing is that the people that Tompkins worked under, some of those people were involved in the USS Akron and the USS Macon, that they were the kind of Navy's first flying aircraft carriers. So people don't know that the Navy had in the 1930s flying aircraft carriers. They were these helium-filled dirigibles, and they could land. I think they were called Skyhawk airplanes on them. So they were a flying aircraft carrier. So the Navy was working on these in the 1920s and 1930s, and the engineer involved in that was Bill Tompkins' boss at Douglas Aircraft Company, Dr. Wolfgang Klemperer.
Wow.
So the Navy in the 50s, in the 1950s, was asking the Douglas Aircraft Company, in particular this guy Klemperer, who they've worked with in the past, to design a space carrier using all of these advanced anti-gravity torsion field technologies and so forth that the Navy was aware of. And apparently, according to Bill Tompkins, the first prototypes that they used were these nuclear powered submarines, and the USS Nautilus was the first one. So Jazz, if you want to put that up.
Yeah, so I guess they're going off of that airtight design, so repurposing that from an ocean environment to a space environment, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So William Tompkins was a model maker and an early designer, right, for the Navy?
That's right, yeah.
So when he created these designs, they were just conceptual. Was there somebody who would then take those concepts, and do we know for sure or for certain that these concepts that were on paper and modeled, you know, in a physical miniature form, did they ever actually go from paper or model to practical?
Well, Tompkins wasn't part of going from the design to the actual building of the prototypes. He said that his work was in the design. That's what they did at Douglas's think tank, and it was called Advanced Design. I mean, so that's what they did, that they were the ones that would come up with these elaborate designs and
illustrations, right?
But it would be, you know, very specific, you know, like you're building a model. You're like, yeah, you're designing something that's very specific in terms of the technologies that goes in it. And he was saying that with these Nautilus class submarines, that the design was you swap out, say, the propeller system at the end for some kind of anti-gravity system. And then they already were nuclear powered, but then rather than having a fission engine, you would have like a fusion engine or something like that. Swap that out so you have sufficient power to generate the anti-gravity field, so that submarine could lift itself up out of the ocean, into the atmosphere and into space. So he said that was their design project. That was one of the design projects, and so. Yeah, that was really the predecessor to these very large space carriers that Tompkins said were like a kilometer or more in length.
So I guess when it comes to like cigar-shaped UFO sightings, maybe some of those were these test craft, right, in earlier decades. Is that what you're kind of like insinuating? Some of these like, are instead of a submarine, a cigar-shaped UFO could have been some of our own craft, is what you're trying to say.
Well, I think when they're testing these craft, they were doing it in very remote facilities like China Lake or in Utah. Bill Tompkins said that the Navy began using the Utah facility pretty early on for developing the space carriers. So Dugway Proving Grounds, that whole area there, Wasatch Mountains. I haven't been there, so I don't know the geography all that well, but it's a vast area and very remote. And while there have been a few UFO sightings there, you know, it's very different to a place like Area 51 where, you know, you can get people driving from Las Vegas and just, you know, checking it all out. But these areas were very remote. So I don't know when they were testing these prototypes, that they would do it in areas like, you know, there have been sightings of like cigar-shaped craft over New York City. So, you know, I think there was one in 1950, a very famous one. And I don't think something like that would have been one of these prototype submarines, at least from the US side, because I think that was, Tompkins said that the submarine prototypes were being developed more in the 70s as a precursor to the full-fledged space carriers. So if you're having cigar-shaped craft being sighted and photographed in the 50s, then, you know, we're probably talking about something that was either an extraterrestrial craft or say a German craft.
Interesting. Or possibly non-human intelligence. Is that something you leave open?
Totally. We're talking like the cryptos, terrestrials, or the cryptids. Yeah, they definitely have some of their own cigar-shaped craft. It seems to be a logical design because, you know, submarines are very useful. I mean, you need a submarine if you're going to go explore under the surface. But that same design that makes a submarine suitable for, you know, these kind of like highly pressurized environments under the ocean, that also makes them suitable for going out into space because you're protected from, you know, radiation and the vacuum and all of that.
Yeah, I could imagine. Do you think something like a TR-3B sighting or like the Phoenix Lights could be one of these carriers that you know, William Tompkins was speaking about?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think, as far as I know, that the Phoenix Lights, I mean, that was someone or some entity or group that wanted to be seen. You know, I mean, if you're testing craft, you're not going to test it over a, you know, a large metropolitan area like Phoenix. I mean,
so, yeah, that's right.
So I don't think it was the Navy, because as far as I can tell, the Navy is a really, you know, they know how to keep secrets. They know how to test things in remote areas. I think the Navy is very much in favor of disclosure, but they still want to do it on their terms. So I think that probably would have been Phoenix Lights. I think that would have been someone else, some off-world group, a non-human intelligence.
Yeah, very possibly. In my recent documentary, I talk about transmedium objects like USOs that have been reported throughout history, objects that are spherical or, you know, the traditional cigar-shaped, like a submarine. And then sometimes even triangles coming out of the ocean and then going off into the atmosphere or supposedly out to space. And in this documentary, you know, I got to talk with Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet, former Rear Admiral, who served for the Navy for 32 years. And 7 of those years, he was the chief oceanographer for the Navy, and while on exercise, he saw this Go Fast UFO UAP video that was released post 2017 by the To the Stars Academy guys. And essentially, that's like this oblong object, no traditional flight surfaces, that the Navy scrambled some, I think they were F-18s. Upgraded to intercept this flying over the ocean in their testing grounds. And, you know, Tim Gallaudet became aware of that through an IPSEC server email thread with his chain of command. And the next day, that video and that email thread was wiped from his email server, therefore his computer. And just goes to show there's a lot of information control regarding this subject still. And I really like this man because he's trying to, from a ocean science perspective, as well as a military defense perspective, bring out more disclosure and transparency about the subject to the public. And that's currently what he's trying to do. He works for, independently 9 to 5. He's got his normal hustle, but then as a analyst and advisor to some capacity, but then he's doing for free stuff with the Saul Foundation, headed up by Gary Nolan and a bunch of other really interesting advocates for disclosure.
I know he just released a white paper for the Salt Foundation on the topic of these transmedium fast movers or USOs. So a very interesting paper. I read through it very closely. I thought there were some areas that he didn't cover, but I just wanted to get your view on, you know, what he did cover that you thought was really noteworthy.
Well, yeah, I think he really walks you through what we know about the oceans, right? From a scientific perspective in the mainstream, we really have embarked on a study of the oceans to a small scale. So the ocean bed, we only know about 25% of the planet's ocean beds have been mapped. And that's, you know, only a small percentage of that 25% is done with modern technology, because we really embarked in the 1800s with our original navies in the oceans to start mapping that. So a lot of this needs to be updated. We need to understand what's down there in our oceans. And then on top of that, the actual ocean volume, the different tables of ocean going all the way down to the abyss, the large trenches at the bottom of the ocean, we don't understand a lot of that and what could exist there. So these known unknowns should empower us to look into the domain of the ocean and factor in the idea from a modern scientific perspective that there could possibly be a non-human intelligence there, or there could be UAPs there that are maybe not from the American arsenal, from the military arsenal. They could be from an adversary. So we have to kind of like broaden the understanding in the mainstream about our oceans, I think more than ever now. And that's one of the major things he touched on there. He also gave chronology of, you know, how disclosure has been going since post 2017 with the groundbreaking New York Times article that Ralph Blumenthal and Leslie Keene were responsible for penning and publishing, authoring. So all of the sort of things that have taken place, including the startup of the UAP task force and how David Grush has recently come out as a whistleblower when he was part of the UAP task force interviewing, you know, apparently 40 different whistleblowers that have all touched the UAP issue to some degree over the past decades, whether they're working on special access programs and supposed reverse engineering programs on UAP or UFO technology, or just people that have witnessed this stuff firsthand and know that there's a non-human intelligence interacting with our planet.
Yeah, I think that's important that this kind of non-human intelligence that's interacting has quite a presence in the oceans. In his white paper, I mean, it was good to see that he acknowledges that a lot of what's known about the ocean is classified. I think that's exactly right, that a lot of it isn't released. And I think his paper's a good one in terms of pitching it at a professional class, people that are still trying to make sense of this whole field, you know, how real is this, what's lying at the bottom of the oceans. But one of the areas he didn't touch on, and I wanted to get your opinion on it, are these ancient legends. You have these ancient legends like the Babylonians talked about Oannes, the sea god, and the Phoenicians talked about Dagon, the merman god. And they in these ancient legends, you had this god who came from the oceans and gave wisdom to humans, where they shared their knowledge about the writing, the arts, and sciences. So in the legends of history, you have, I think, evidence whatever you want to call it, historical records, that does point to the existence of these non-human intelligences in the oceans.
Yeah, originating from there. I think one of my favorite stories is, Zachariah Stitchin's depiction of the ancient cuneiform tablets that came from pre-Babylonian time even, and how in this story of creation here on the planet, how humans were made by the Anunnaki, one of these sort of Anunnaki kings, which is an alien, like a non-human intelligence that came from space when they came to Earth to create this biosphere and apparently do some work here. One of them, I believe, is Enlil, that lived in the ocean. His domain was the ocean.
Oh,
he was the commander.
Enki.
Enki.
Yeah. Exactly. So, like, And then they were at war with each other, right? Which is another interesting thing. What if Enki never left? Who knows? I mean, it's an interesting idea. Or what if Enki's technology never left? What if some of these UAPs or transmedium UFOs that are being observed throughout the decades coming from our oceans or different water bodies throughout the world, lakes, deep lakes, and so on. What if that's an autonomous drone that's been built by a non-human intelligence that's still lingering and circumnavigating the globe and keeping track of things? Who knows? Mm-hmm. It's all possible in science fiction, that's for sure.
Yeah, so the history does kind of point to these ancient civilizations in the oceans. And I've actually kind of interviewed two people that have described going to what I think is probably the same underwater city complex in the Bermuda Triangle region. And that what they described with kind of three biodomes that were connected by some tube. And I've written about it, but I just wanted to get your reaction to that. What do you think of the possibility that there are these underwater city complexes in places like the Bermuda Triangle?
It's very possible. I mean, look, we just don't know enough about what's down there in the bottom of our oceans. I know that recently I was talking with a show host, Julian Dory, and he pointed out that there's pyramids at the bottom of the Bermuda Triangle that have been found with LIDAR and sonar scans of the seabed. So what are those doing there? And we have all kinds of tales. I think the USS Scorpion was a submarine that went missing in the Bermuda Triangle some decades back, which is touched on at the beginning of The Abyss, which is one of James, Cameron's, one of James Cameron's famous earlier films that basically feed the public with the idea that there's a non-human intelligence that look like aliens swimming around and existing in a base at the bottom of the ocean. At the beginning of that film, that submarine that has that encounter is in the Bermuda Triangle area. So it's like there's stuff that's written into our fiction, but there's also ideas that could exist in reality. I mean, it would make life a lot more interesting if that was true, wouldn't it?
I think Hollywood does often give us a kind of a soft disclosure of what's really going on. And that James Cameron movie, it's interesting that right now, actually, I just found out that the director's cut edition of The Abyss is being re-released, that James Cameron included additional footage, and that has just been re-released. And I was just notified by Amazon that it's being mailed out to me. So, and what I find interesting about The Abyss is that, yeah, you have the non-human intelligence on the bottom of the ocean and you have all the drama about what's going on. But then you have this huge ship surfacing on the out of the Bermuda Triangle area. And one of the people I was referring to that went to this underground or this underwater civilization, he says he's been on six missions to this space arc, this huge space arc in the Atlantic Ocean. First it was in the Bermuda Triangle and it's moved more recently into the kind of more towards the middle of the Atlantic. But he described it as this huge craft that's down there at the bottom of the ocean. And so I thought it was very interesting that The Abyss is being released and it shows something like a space arc surfacing.
Yeah, at the very end, right? That's a really amazing scene. I think Richard Dolan touches on some of the Navy encounters that have happened throughout history with regards to ocean-based phenomenon in the documentary that I released, Transmedium. And I think it's possible maybe something like that has happened, where a massive craft has surfaced. Even Lou Elizondo spoke out in the last few years about a Navy encounter where this large black disc-shaped craft came from the depths of the ocean around Puerto Rico. And they were doing an exercise, the military, the Navy was doing an exercise to these Navy SEALs to retrieve a warhead that apparently had sunken. And this craft came up and sucked it away from their men. And apparently there was some big panic. So I don't know. I mean, like, it kind of touches on the idea that there's something going on in that Puerto Rico area, which is just at the corner of this Bermuda Triangle.
That's right. Well, we already talked a little bit about the secret space programs, but I wanted to get your thoughts on this. And you mentioned the TR-3 flying triangle, and you talked about Edgar Fouché in your secret space UFOs documentary. So, yeah, Edgar Fouché, he's a fascinating character. I know he gave a lecture, I think it was in 1999, where he kind of like just exposed what he had found out from Area 51. So you want to kind of walk us through what Edgar Fouché had to say about the TR-3B and how real that is today?
Sure. So he really, started hitting the UFO conference scene. Spoke at a MUFON conference, and I included some clips in this documentary, Rise of the TR-3B. And basically, it touched on all of the rumors and myths around this super top secret anti-gravitic early attempt at an anti-gravitic, for lack of a better term, like space elevator or space crew and technology carrier, because it was supposed to take large amounts of people, like an apartment full of people, apartment building full of people, and possibly like even tanks into space. You know what I mean? It was quite a roomy object, if you believe it. He said that it was using this kind of technology at the center of it, which was creating that lift and zero gravity sort of effect. It was called the MFD, magnetic field disruptor, and it rotated. It was like a rotating superconductor sort of thing. It had a sub-zero mercury metallic substance at the center of it that was rotated at super high speeds, and that created this lift effect. 99 or 98% of the gravity would have been negated. And then it used for movement, you know, left and right and stuff like that, these traditional hydrogen sort of jet propulsion on each corner of the craft, like these round white lights that some people have seen under these large black triangles. And it was a large black triangle, if you believe it. I can't say for sure it's all true, but he, whenever he got a speaking engagement, you know, he would say that this was, most of the black triangles are man-made. The anti-gravitic looking ones, the alien looking ones, not the, B-2 bomber or something like that.
Right, yeah. I think he said that they became kind of operational in late 80s, and that they were flying out of Area 51 all over the world. And he mentioned a base in Scotland as well. So I suspect, you know, that Belgium flying triangle sighting.
Wait,
wave. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that probably was these TR3Bs being kind of used around the place.
Possibly. Another source that I spoke to, he states that maybe the very first maiden flight for this object was 1979. So, I mean, to put it into perspective, the A2 Blackbird, A12 Blackbird, which was created for CIA's spy plane purposes, basically was a modified SR-71. That was being actively built and tested in 1968, and that wasn't decommissioned and released to the public as real technology till the 1980s. So, I mean, it's possible that there's been these black projects building TR-3B type objects for decades that will never be declassified if it's in the military's best interests.
Yeah, well, that's the key question is, will they ever be declassified in the sense of like, well, these craft were built in the 70s or 80s, or will they be just kind of rolled out as something recently created by the aerospace companies to just kind of like, you know, put an end to the conspiracy theories that these things have been around for 40, 50 years?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think it's in the military's best interest to ever admit something like that, right? Because it's like creating a vulnerability strategically against other adversary nations if you tell them, you show them your cards technologically.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, this brings me to the Gary McKinnon case, because I always thought that that was a very significant one, that in 2001 and 2002, after he watches the Disclosure Project press conference, he starts to hack into the Pentagon and NASA, and he finds images of these cigar-shaped craft. And one of them, someone put together the different details that McKinnon described about this this kind of cigar-shaped craft. And people say, well, this was the USS Hillenkoetter. I don't know. I don't think McKinnon actually ever mentioned names, but some people somehow attributed what McKinnon was saying to this craft. So what do you think of the McKinnon case and the existence of a Solar Warden space program using these kinds of cigar-shaped craft?
I've spoken to Gary McKinnon in the past, and I find him to be a very interesting person. I don't know, what his strategy for breaking into a JPL Jet Propulsion Lounge server to look at these proprietary photos on a dial-up modem back in the day. He just used a brute force technique, which was let's hope that the server IT personnel just forgot to have security turned on and delete the default administrator profile for that server, which is usually just back in, I think it was maybe Windows Server 2000. When he did this, it might have been an earlier version of Windows Server, but you could have a default administrator profile to log in to that OS just by putting administrator and then a blank password and pressing enter. And then when you log in that first time, you can then modify the password and, you know, create better security. But he got in by running that method. And when he looked at these photos, he saw this craft, and he apparently saw a manifest of different personnel that were on these missions, these space-based missions that were a mix of human and off-world personnel, so to speak. So maybe non-human intelligence. I don't know. It's really wild stuff, right? We just have no proof But we do know that because of that act, because he hacked into a server that was highly classified, he was then thrown into jail and threatened to be extradited to the United States for, I think, the better part of 2 decades. And then under Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, she acquitted him or dismissed his case to be extradited to the United States. If he had been extradited under the then sort of terrorist sort of classification of somebody breaking into a security, like a national defense security system like that, he would have gone to Guantanamo Bay, right? Which is where some of the darkest stuff happens to prisoners there. And I think his case was dismissed because he does suffer from, he's on the spectrum of autism. He has Asperger's. And so that kind of protected his rights somewhat to be extradited. And yeah, when I spoke to him, he seems credible. He allowed me to, in an earlier rendition of one of these space-based documentaries about UFOs and stuff, he allowed me to capture his story where he was interviewed with Kerry Cassidy, who's somebody I've spoken to as well.
Let's talk about your 2020 documentary on Bigfoot or Sasquatch. So I know you think it's very important that we put an end to theories or claims that this is all a man-made hoax. So why do you think it's genuine?
Well, I think what's genuine for sure is the Patterson-Gimlin film. Some people call that Creature Patty. Because it was like a female anatomy bipedal ape-looking creature. When I made the documentary, I reached out to the Patterson family, who still hold the rights for that clip, you know, of Patty walking sideways through the Bluff Creek sandbar. And this is Northern California. This is deep wilderness at that point in the 1960s, 1967, I believe, which is well before Chewbacca or any of that space, you know, Star Wars, ape looking costume, special effects were good enough to pull off something that could look real. But yeah, Patty, if you listen to the eyewitness accounts and then you look at the film, which, you know, I zoom in on and slow down frame by frame, you see like anatomy, you see muscles moving, you see these large hairy breasts on the creature. So it looks like it's a real bipedal ape-like being with a big head with a sagittal crest, which is something you typically only see on a gorilla. That's why a gorilla has kind of like a cone-shaped peak to its cranium. You can sort of see that same thing when Patty is walking off in the distance and its back is fully to the camera, the 8mm camera that Bob Gimlin was recording that film with. You see this sort of cone-shaped sort of sagittal crest that's on the top of the head of this creature. So to me, it seems like the working title for that doc back in the day, that was one of my earlier documentaries, which I re-released in 2020. It was originally released in 2016. The title was supposed to be The Last Sasquatch, because I thought that maybe these earlier encounters were more real. But you know, more real than some of the footage you see on YouTube these days, because a lot of it you could fake pretty easily. But, you know, somebody had already made a film called The Last Sasquatch, and it was like a horror film or something. So that kind of screwed me over. So I called it The Unwanted Sasquatch, and it's kind of like this old English play on a creature that is supposed to be scarce, hard to find, and elusive. And that's everything you hear about these creatures when we come across them in the wilderness. And I think it's possible that if it does exist, it is something that apparently has been documented by the the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They had an atlas in the 1970s that they published that they talk about the Sasquatch existing in the Pacific rainforest area, the western side of the United States. So it had been seen enough there by locals and I guess Army Corps engineer personnel that they wanted to put it in their atlas. I don't think it was a joke. I think that it's possible that they had taken it seriously enough to include that because they wanted to make sure if they are constructing something out in the middle of the wilderness in, say, Washington, Northern California, Oregon, these sort of areas, you know, even all the way up to Alaska, we've heard reports of these creatures being seen. Yeah, I think that it's very possible that these creatures, just like the bears in North America, they may not have originated in North America. They may have come across the Bering Land Bridge, that ice bridge that thousands of years ago connected places like ancient China and Russia to our North American continent. And we know that woolly mammoths and bears, other types of flora or fauna, crossed that. So who's to say that there wasn't an ancient creature like the Gigantopithecus or Australopithecus that is this kind of like bipedal ape-like looking creature that, you know, shares some traits with Homo sapiens, but is much larger, much more muscular, covered from head to toe in more fur or hair, or something in between, like an ape and an ape-like man. And it's possible that some of them have existed or survived in scarce population numbers in deep wilderness. And sometimes we come across them and sometimes they come across us.
I was able to interview Jack Kawani Lapsaridis, and I think he's the author of probably the first couple of books or one of the earliest books dealing with the Sasquatch. And he said that as far as he knew, you know, from his research, investigations, and physical contacts with the Sasquatch, he said that they work closely with extraterrestrials. So what do you think of that?
I don't know. I mean, it's something that I keep hearing about in the UFO / Bigfoot world, that's kind of like this crossover. I don't know if there's like enough proof of it, right? Like, I know that we have footcasts and hair samples and sometimes photographs and videos of sightings of these things from these specimens, but I don't see enough photographs, videos, and proof that there's also a UFO that existed in that exact same sighting in that area. We do hear about that from eyewitnesses, that they also have saw UFOs in the sky. But, you know, why is it we never get like a video of the UFO and the Sasquatch at the same time, you know? It's a little bit.
It's right. Well, that's a kind of perennial debate within the UFO community. I mean, you have often people, eyewitnesses, saying that they saw a Sasquatch or interacted with them, or they went on a spacecraft and they seem very credible. They passed lie detector tests and so forth, but they don't have the physical evidence, the photos. So, as far as, I mean, I know as a documentary filmmaker, your focus is on finding the evidence. But what's the balance to be found with those that have really compelling stories, that they're willing to do lie detector tests, but they don't have the physical evidence? How do you bring those people into this equation?
Yeah, I think multiple eyewitnesses sometimes helps corroborate the story. So if you have a case like Travis Walton, where, you know, four other people were present to see the craft, sometimes there's trace evidence left over, strange abnormalities to the growth rate of the trees in the area that the UFO showed up, that, you know, all that kind of data. Then the lie detector tests, that helps, like you said, which in the Travis Walton case, I believe every one of them did lie detector tests and they passed, you know. The only one that Travis Walton supposedly failed was on a live game show that they even admit to the public cannot be taken as a true lie detector test. So that show was made for entertainment. So I think there's all kinds of ways to corroborate eyewitness testimony. I think more eyewitnesses are a good start.
Yeah, I mean, they are definitely a fascinating phenomenon. And I know that it makes sense that they don't want to be identified, because then there's a lot of people out there that would like to have a Sasquatch trophy for their wall. And I mean, that's the unfortunate truth. There's a lot of hunters out there that would like, yeah, they're out there, let's go hunt them down. It's just absurd, but that's the unfortunate truth about our species.
Yeah. Let's hang a Sasquatch head on the wall, eh?
I mean, it's crazy. Crazy. So what are you working on now? I mean, what's your next documentary project?
I'm working on a number of films, one of which is on the USO and UFO phenomenon surrounding the island nation of Puerto Rico. All the strange stuff going on there. So I've been doing that. Been working on one on an abduction case that's quite famous. I'm interested in profiling the sort of secret space stuff. I mean, maybe I should talk to you about that sometime. I'd love to fly down and get your take on the whole secret space program. As long as you don't get in trouble, I don't want you to get sued. Okay, Michael?
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, there is that element of intellectual property being asserted over some of this information, but I mean, the thing is, William Tompkins, his information kind of like began in the 1940s. So that's a nice solid foundation to like really expand our understanding of what's really going on. So Darcy, I want to thank you for being on Exopolitics today. So where do people go if they want to watch some of your videos or get in touch with you?
Yeah, if they want to see my films, they're available, most of them, on Amazon Prime, Apple TV. You can just search my name, Darcy Weir, and a whole catalog of my films will come up. And Tubi TV as well, if you want to check it out there with some ads. My website is just my studio name, occultjourneys.com. Don't worry, there's nothing evil related to that. It's just based on the word occulta, which means like hidden, from the Latin sort of Greek foundation. And I'm Darcy Weir Films on Instagram and @OCodeJourneys on Twitter. Hit me up. Happy to connect. Love to hear maybe some of your experience or stories to include in an upcoming documentary, possibly.
Fantastic.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.